Good morning. Today's daf in Sukkah Lamed Vav. We are continuing our discussion of the Esrog. Yesterday we started with the Mishnah, detailing, outlining all the various characteristics of an Esrog that would either qualify or disqualify the Esrog. Yesterday we dealt with the agricultural halachas, meaning the Esrog is a fruit, and as we noted yesterday, the significant difference between the Esrog and the other of the Dalaminim is the other of the Dalaminim are just twigs and branches, and so they are not as much subject to the agricultural halachas of Truma and Meiser and Arla, etc., etc. On the other hand, the Esrog is a fruit, and so therefore it is subject to all those halachas. And the simple summary of yesterday's daf is that if the halacha demands that this fruit cannot be eaten, let's give the primary example of Arla, which is what we discussed yesterday. So if it's a eno bar achila, if you cannot eat it, the halacha, the agricultural halacha demands that you can't eat it. In other words, it's within 3 years of its planting. So then it's can't use it as part of the dalaminim. Now the way we explained yesterday, the way Rashi explained yesterday, is that if you can't eat it, it's a failure of lachem. It lacks the lachem requirement, meaning by virtue of the fact that the Torah demands it be yours. So yours means that you can make usage out of it, i.e., you can eat it. Once you can't eat it, so therefore it's not lachem, and therefore it does not qualify as a kosher esrog. It would stand to reason. We didn't discuss this yesterday, but I'm just now thinking out loud. It would stand to reason that the lachem requirement, which is only on day one, so it doesn't extend to day number two, and then presumably it could be used from day two and onward. Although I'm not sure about that, and that's just a thought which I haven't fully developed yet. So really, I shouldn't have said anything. But regardless, notwithstanding, that's what we learned in yesterday's Gemara, and we went through not just Arla, but we went through a number of other of the agricultural halachas. What if the esrog is truma? What if the esrog is meister sheni? What would then be the status of the kashrus of that esrog vis-a-vis the dalminim? We talked about demai yesterday. Good. So we discussed many of the very basic agricultural halachas as it affects the esrog. We are now going to continue with the Gemara where we left off yesterday. We're starting with Alsa Chazazis on Lamed Hey Amud Beis. It's about 10 lines, 12 lines from the bottom of the Amud. And now we're going to be talking about the physical imperfections that exist within an esrog. So Alsa Chazazis, so we're talking now about a blistered esrog. So if you recall the Mishnah said that there's a distinction between whether the blisters are on the majority of the surface area of the esrog versus when it's not on the majority of the surface area. So if it finds itself on the majority, so then the esrog would be pasul. On the minority, the esrog would be kasher. That's what we learned in the Mishnah. And now the Gemara is going to try to qualify. At first, we're going to try to qualify the first statement of the Mishnah. And that is that if the esrog is blistered on its majority, so the Mishnah says it's pasul. So we start with the Gemara also chazazis. Amr of chista davrzeh rabbeinu agadol amru. So this was said by Rabbeinu Agadol. Rabbeinu Agadol, when Rav Chisda is making references, talking about Rav, his Rebbe, and the Hamakum Yebezro, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be in assistance, meaning he should get Siyat Dishmaya. So Lo Shano Lab Hamakum Echad, that's only when the blisters are occurring in one location. Ava Bishnaim V'Shosh Mekomos Kasher, but let's say that the blisters on the Esrog are spread out through the Esrog, and they are not contiguous, but rather they are in various locations. Now, the aggregate total of the blisters would, in fact, be the majority. However, they just happen to be on different areas of the esrog. So what he would like to try to argue is that because they're not contiguous and not in one location, therefore it would be kosher, despite the fact that it is the majority. So Amale Rava Adarabba. So when Rava hears this, so he says to Rav Chisda, I don't understand. So Bishnam Vishosha Mekamos will have like a manumer, apostle. If anything, look, the fact that it is now spread out over the esrog, even though it is non-contiguous, but now it is spotted, and if anything, that is a further lack of hiddur, and for sure the esrog under those circumstances would be pasul. So it can't be. It can't be that when Rav made this distinction, it was going on the first statement of the Mishnah. So Ella I itmar asefa itmar. So the Gemara says, fine, we're going to have to now revisit what Rav said and what Rav meant. What Rav said, well, we know what he said. He made a distinction between one area versus multiple areas, but now he wasn't modifying the first part of the Mishnah, rather the second part of the Mishnah. Al mi'uto kasher, when the Mishnah said that if the blistered esrog is only covering a minority of the surface area, so the Mishnah says it's kasher. Now on that, here comes Rav. Amr of chista davar zeh rabbeinu agadol amr v'amokum yebezro. Lo shenu ela b'makom echad. Yes, it's true that if the esrog is blistered and it's only covering a minority of the surface area, it'd be kosher. But that's only if it is in one location. But let's say the blisters are distributed on the esrog in two, three different locations. So under those circumstances, it would in fact be pasul. Because the esrog now looks splat, it looks like a namer, right? Literally in modern Hebrew, a leopard, upasul, and therefore it's going to be disqualified. So basically now what Rav comes out to be is a chumrah on the Mishnah, meaning the Mishnah says a minority of surface area being blistered is going to be kosher, and now on that Rav qualifies and says yes, that's true, but if the blisters now are spread out over the esrog, even though the actual blisters themselves are only a minority of the total surface area, but because they are now spread out, and because now it looks menumar, so therefore that's a detraction of hider, and therefore will be disqualified. And Rava says, but however, if you find a blister on the chotem, literally the nose of the esrog, so even at any amount, even at a mashu, so it's going to be pasul. So we are now making a distinction within the esrog versus the basic body of the esrog and the nose of the esrog. Now, obviously, this comes out to make very, very practical halacha, because when looking at an esrog, so you want to make sure that there is a lack of imperfection on the chotem, on the nose of the esrog. What is the nose of the esrog? So a lot of discussion within the Rashi and what Rashi means. I'll read the Rashi, v'chotmo, ove gavosha meshapea, misham, v'yorin l'tzad rosho. So Rashi says that when that esrog starts making its incline, right, it starts now angling in to get to the pitam, so it's at that point in time that's called the chotam. Next Rashi, afilu koshu upasol, shenira sham, le'inayim, yosem mishar mekam moshebo. So Rashi over here is explaining why we more machmir with the chotam, because that's the place of the esrog that draws the eye much better, much stronger than any other location of the esrog. Sheba oso ove adam nosein einav. It's at that thickness that people are really spending their attention. That's what captures the eye. Good. So what does Rashi mean when he's describing the area of the chotam? So there's a lot of discussion, and again, this is a daf, and We're not gonna go that far deep into Rashi, but Rashi may just simply be saying that at the point of incline, meaning not the entire area, but just simply at the point of incline, it's at that area there that it's called the chotam, and it's in that area you have the highest sensitivity to any kind of imperfection. Where if you were to find a blister in any point at that horizontal line, at that parallel line of incline, it's at that point in time that the esrog becomes pasul, but he's not talking about the entire top area. Others contend that Rashi is referring to the entire top area, meaning from the start, from the point where it makes its incline all the way up to the pitum. So that is what Rashi is describing, the entire area. Okay, and that's just all within Rashi. And there are other Rishonim, and there are many, whatever. There's a much deeper dive that we can go into the Gemara over here, but for our purposes right now, that is just a good scratching of the surface of our Gemara. Not la pitmaso, if the pitum is taken off, tan rabbi yitzchak ben elazar, not la buchnaso. Good. So the Gemara quotes a brisa, which is a slightly different version of what we saw in our Mishnah, but hopefully to help us understand that when the pitum is removed, the esrog would be pasul. And in the brisa, it describes it not as a pitum, but rather as a buchna. Now, buchan is a mortar and pestle. Okay, I always forget which one's the bowl and which one's the crusher, but we're talking here about the crusher, right? The part that goes in and pounds. That's the buchna. Okay, anyway, what comes out now is that the Gemara is trying to give us a description of what is the pitum. It's the buchna. Okay, now Rashi over here quotes his Rebbeim. Rashi quotes two of his Rebbeim, and they actually give divergent positions of what exactly we're describing over here. So the first position within Rashi is what we're used to hearing, and that is the pitum is the top of the esrog, right? That the little flower that stands on the top of the esrog, right? What you and I classically describe as the pitum. So that's what the Gemara is making reference to over here. Rashi does, however, quote another one of his Rebbeim, who is insistent that the pitum that's being described over here is actually on the end of the esrog, the other end of the esrog, the ukutz, right? The part that goes into the tree. Excuse me. And when the Braisa describes that the buchnas come out, it means that not just the stem came out, but the interior of the esrog, meaning the stem going all the way into the interior of the esrog, also came out as well, and therefore it would be chaser, it would be lacking, as you're missing part of the esrog. Okay, Rashi does favor the first pshat, which is what we traditionally call the pitum. Okay, good. Next, niklaf, if the skin is peeled, amar Rava hai esrog de iglid ka'ahina sumka kashera. So Rava says a halacha that if your esrog is peeled, the entire outer layer of the esrog has been peeled off, so it would be kasher. Now the obvious question which the Gemara asks, v'anan tanan, niklaf pasol, that goes against the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that if it's peeled, it's going to be pasol. So lo kasher, the Gemara says, okay, we could resolve it. As we turn to the top of Lamed Vav Amud Aleph, habakula, habemiksas, so it depends how much is peeled. If the entire outer layer of the esrog is peeled, so it would be kasher. Now I'm saying the Gemara over like Rashi. If the entire outer layer is peeled, so then it would be kasher. However, miksasa. But if only parts of the outer layer are peeled, and so you have now sections which are peeled, sections which are unpeeled, so then minumarhu. So Rashi says that now we're back to it looking splotted, right? Like there are splotches, and it's uneven, and it's not uniform, and therefore it would be a lack of hiddur. That is the way Rashi presents the Gemara and the distinction between a fully peeled esrog and a partially peeled esrog. So for Rashi, a fully peeled esrog would be kasher, and a partially peeled esrog would be pasul. It is a little bit counterintuitive, but once again, once you have this concept of menumar, so obviously Rashi is working with what we learned just previously in the Gemara. If you want to see an alternative way to explain the Gemara, I'm not going to go through it, but if you want to see it, so see the first Dibra Maschel Tosos HaBekula HaBemeksasa, where he quotes Rabbeinu Chananu. Rabbeinu Chananu says just the opposite, that the Kula would be Pasul and Meksasa would be Kosher, and see Rabbeinu Chananu, who proves that this is, in fact, the better way to read the Gemara. Anyway, we're going to continue in the Gemara. We're on the very top of Lamed Vav Amanalv Nistak Nikev. So, Tini Ula Rabbi Chanina. We are now talking about where the esrog is perforated. Now, to be clear, it says Rashi, we're not talking about where a piece of the esrog is missing. If a piece of the esrog is missing, so then it's chaser, and then obviously it's no good. The esrog has to be bishlemus, it has to be a complete esrog, and so once it's missing, so then it's no good. I know, at least I'm thinking this, and I would imagine you're thinking this as well. The previous Gemara that we just did talked about where the entire peel has been removed, and yet, according to Rashi, the esrog is kasher. It doesn't seem to be a lekicha tama. It seems to be part of the esrog is missing. And what you will have to say, these are just outside thoughts right now. What you'll have to say is that the outer layer is not considered part and parcel of the esrog. And it could very well be that the entire outer layer is removed, the peel is removed, and it's still considered a shalem, a complete esrog. Okay, but meanwhile, if any of the inside of the esrog is taken out, the rind and certainly the pulp, so then it's chaser and it's no good. What we're discussing now, says Rashi, is that basically what I did is I took a needle and I perforated the esrog, but no part of the esrog is missing. I imagine that some liquid will come out, but in other words, but there's none of the rind is removed, none of the pulp is removed. So now the way Rashi understands the Gemara over here is that if I took the needle and put it all the way through the esrog, so at that point in time, it's pasul, even though none of the esrog is actually missing. Or alternatively, let's say I put an imprint on the esrog. It's the size of an isser. An isser is a standard coin that was popular back in the time of the Gemara. Again, nothing removed from the esrog, right? Rashi basically says is that you took a thick, you took a thick peg and you pushed it into the esrog. So basically what you did is you made an indentation in the esrog. But again, nothing removed. So under these circumstances, so it is going to be, it's going to be pasul. And it's true, says Rashi, that the Mishnah says that a nekev which is not chaser would be kosher, but Rashi says that that's exactly what our Gemara is doing over here. It's telling us that there's a limit to that halacha. I mean, if the perforation went all the way through the esrog from one side to the other, so it's at that point in time, we have now crossed the limit, and that would be pasul. Similarly, if the indentation was as thick as an eser, even though it didn't go all the way through, once again, that's beyond the limit, and that would be pasul. By Rava Noda Besrog Simani Trefa Mahu. Rava wants to know, let's say you have something which would be considered a trefa by an animal, and you took a analogous scenario by an esrog, so what would be the status over there? Now, the Gemara is going to do something that is fascinating right now, and that is take the laws of trefa and basically apply them to what would qualify and disqualify an esrog. Now, obviously, we're operating within two totally different worlds, right? Trefa, obviously, is where an animal has some sort of hole, perforation, split in one of its internal organs. And that would mean that the animal no longer is a healthy animal. In fact, it is in critical condition and it will die. And so therefore the animal is rendered a trefa. Over here, we're talking about a fruit, right? And the words life and death when it comes to a fruit are obviously not the same, the same as an animal. So, but meanwhile, what the Gemara is doing, and it's just so fascinating, is that the Gemara is basically going to take the rules of trefa and bring it over here to esrog. So that's what Rebbe wants to know. Let's say by an esrog you have simanei trefa, what would be the halacha? So the Gemara says, okay, but let's be specific. Maikami ba'ilei. E niklaf tanina. Now, if you're asking me about niklaf, well, we just discussed it. Meaning, we don't need to borrow from the laws of trefa to adjudicate the question of niklaf. We just learned the halacha by niklaf. So I don't need trefa to help me out. And e nizdak tanina. Now, there's a split. Now, by hilchos trefa, so the split would be by the windpipe. So, right, if one of the cartilages of the windpipe is split down from one end to another laterally, so the animal would be a trefa. And now the Gemara wants to know what would be the halacha regarding esrog. But the Gemara says tanina, meaning I don't need the halachas of trefa to help me over here because our Mishnah taught us already. The Mishnah taught us that if I have a crack in the esrog is pasul. So simane trefa is not helping me. And e nikev tanina. Now, if we're talking about a perforation, once again, don't need it. I don't need the halachas of trefa. And by the way, Rashi points out over here, perforation would be by the membrane of the brain of an animal, right? If the membrane is perforated, so then the animal would be a trefa. Anyway, all this stated, the Gemara says, look, we have the halachas stated clearly over here about niklaf, about nistak, about nikev. So I don't need simanei trefa to help me out over here. So ki kami ba'ilei kedeula, I'm Rav Yochanan. So the Gemara says, I'll tell you where one of the halachas of trefas may educate us, may inform us over here by an esrog, and that would be the following. So let's say the lungs are ready to pour out like a jug. So that means to say that the fleshy part of the lung is now been liquefied. Okay. With a quick consult before the daf today. So it could just easily be that the lungs are infected. And so they went from solid form to liquid form, but the external pouch of the lungs is still intact. And so it's a reish nishpacha kiketon. So you could basically pour the lungs out. Obviously, back in the day, so there was no way of knowing this until after shechita, but let's say after shechting, so the lungs were taken out. And meanwhile, the lungs are basically a balloon, right, filled with water, and they just simply pour out. So on this, interestingly enough, the Gemara says that the animal is not a trefa. The Gemara says the animal is kshira. Simpunahu. So the Gemara says that's true, but the bronchial tubes still have to be intact. Meaning, yes, that the general flesh of the lungs are liquefied, but the bronchial tubes still have to be intact. Good. So anyway, so we just learned together that that if the contents are liquefied, as long as the external still is able to hold it in, so it would be kasher. And also you have to remember the modification of Rava, and that is that the bronchial tubes still have to be intact. So halokaima simpunai trefa. Now, if the bronchial tubes are not intact, then basically it is a liquid-filled lung in total, so then it's the animal would be trefa. So hachamai. So now what we're going to do is that we're going to take that halacha of trefa and now bring it over to an esrog. Now, here it's going to be a challenge because in the analogy, so we need to find the bronchial tubes. I'm putting that in quotes. We need to find the bronchial tubes of the esrog. So Rashi says it's basically the seeds, right? The seeds are going to be viewed as the bronchial tubes. So basically now I have an esrog where I'm holding it. So I know it's basically liquid content, but the seeds are intact. So if by an animal, it's considered a kosher animal. Mm-hmm. So now maybe if I took that halacha and brought it over to esrog, so maybe I say it would be kosher esrog. This is what the Gemara is attempting to do. So the Gemara says, okay, Dilma, Hasamud lo shala be'avira hadabari, avahach de shala be'avira, struchim esrachas, udim lo shna. The Gemara says, look, the analogy may not be a perfect analogy because when we're talking about the lungs, So at least the lungs now are encased within the thoracic cavity of the animal. So the lungs have a chance of regeneration. The lungs have a chance of healing. However, when you're talking about the estrog is exposed, is outside. And so the Gemara says the analogy may not be a great analogy, and that's why the Gemara says, I don't know. Meaning, although I know what the halacha would be regarding treifa by an animal, I don't know if that can now carry over into the arena of an esrog. Tashma, the Gemara says, okay, I do have a brisa, and at first reading of the brisa, it sounds like we're discussing our very issue. The brisa is going to be covering a number of different psulim. For our purposes right now, we're focusing just on the first part of the brisa. We are eventually going to deal with the other parts of the brisa. The brisa opens up, esrog tapuach, saruach. If the esrog is inflated and saruach, and it becomes smelly. Kavush, shaluk, if it was cooked. If it was pickled or cooked. Kushi, if it was black, lavan or white. Umenumar, or it had spots. Puzzle. In all these circumstances, the esrog would be puzzle. And we're just continuing in the brisa, even though we really want to focus on the first part of the brisa. Esrog kador puzzle. If it is shaped as a ball, it would be puzzle. V'yeshomim af hatiyom. And some suggest that even if it is a twin esrog, Rashi describes it over here, kind of like a Siamese esrog. So that would haboser, or if it is a immature esrog. So Rabbi Kiva posav a chachamim machshirim. So Rabbi Kiva says it would be puzzle. The chachamim say that it is kasher. Gadla b'tfus. Let's say as the esrog is growing, you put it in a form, in a mold. And so now the esrog will take the shape of the mold. V'asu kamin birya acheres. And the mold is now going to have the esrog actually develop into a different shape, a non-esrog shape. So then puzzle, under all these circumstances, it would be puzzle. Good. Adkan divrei habraisa. We are going to come back and explain all the other cases of the braisa. But meanwhile, just for our purposes right now, ketani miyas tapuach saruach. The braisa is talking about where it is inflated and it is smelly. So my love tapuach mi b'chutz v'saruach mi b'fnim. So the Gemara says, now ostensibly, this is talking about one case. Now, it is inflated because, at least at this point, we think, because it's filled with liquid. Meaning what happened was is that the interior of the esrog basically liquefied, and it's saruach mi b'fnim. So it started rotting on the inside. Okay, but what the brisa now is telling me is that if it's tafuach visaruach, basically liquefied insides, the outside is still holding everything intact, it's basically a water-filled balloon. So the brisa says it would be pusel. And that would now inform us that the question that we asked previously, meaning we look to the laws of treifa to try to help us in that case, where the esrog is basically liquid on the inside. But again, the Gemara says that the case of treifa is different because the lungs are interior. The esrog is not inside of anything. Fine, but now we have the brisa, and the brisa seems to be discussing this very issue. So the Gemara says, lo, idivi idimi b'chutz. Nope, the Gemara says it's not correct. Really, the truth of the matter is that they're both, but the brisa here is not describing one case. The brisa is actually describing two different cases. So one case of the brisa is that the esrog is bloated. It's a bloated esrog. That's one scenario. But it's only talking about the exterior. It's not talking about the interior. And the other scenario is it's saruach. It starts smelling. In other words, it's moldy, whatever. However, it got to the point of sircha. And as a result of that, so it's unpleasant. So, but what the point of the Gemara is that it's not talking about one case. It's not talking about a water filled esrog. And so once again, we no longer are able to conclude on the question of, on the question of Rava. Rava wanted to know if it was a water filled esrog, would it be kosher? Would it be pasul? So again, now in two attempts, the Gemara basically has not concluded in either of the attempts. Either what the Gemara tried to do is go to the halachas of treifa to try to draw a parallel case. The Gemara ends up saying, nope, you can't extend what we know by treifa over here to esrog. They're different. And then the Gemara quoted a brisa, which seemingly also tried to draw a conclusion, but the Gemara says, but there is another way to read the brisa. And so therefore the Gemara left the question of Rava inconclusive. Amar. Okay, and now what we have is a fantastic opportunity, meaning we just quoted a brisa. The brisa dealt with many different types of psulim as it relates to an esrog. So the Gemara now is going to be discussing the other cases in the Brisa. Esrog kushi pasul va tanya kushi kasher. So the Gemara says that, look, we in the Brisa learned that the esrog kushi is going to be pasul. We have the Brisa that says that an esrog kushi is kasher. That's called a stira. Now, wait, we have a little bit more to go in that second Brisa. Doma l'kushi pasul. Now, if it is a doma l'kushi, it looks like a kushi esrog, it's going to be pasul. Now, what is going on over here? The distinction in the Brisa, in the second Brisa, between kushi and doma l'kushi. So if you take a look at Rashi over here, Rashi writes, doma l'kushi, shegado kam v'areu shachur. Meaning, the way Rashi understands it is that if it is a, now I'll call kush Ethiopia, not because I really know, but that's generally speaking how it's said over. I could show you Rashi a little bit later on. It does not sound like, according to Rashi, Kush is Ethiopia. It doesn't really matter. The point is going to be the same point, which is that if the esrog, where it grows, indigenous to where it grows, it comes out to looking like a black esrog, that'd be fine, meaning because that's normal. However, if we're growing it here, and the esrogim that grow here, let's call it Eretz Yisrael, or we can call it Bavel, whichever. The esrogim that grow over here, if in fact they are, if they don't normally come out to be a darker shade of esrog, and over here you're growing a darker shade of esrog, that's domela kushi, and that's possible, because that's not what normally grows over here. Okay, that's Rashi's understanding of the difference between kushi versus domela kushi. Anyway, what we have over here is a stira, meaning one brisa says that kushi is kasher, and another brisa says that kushi is pasul. So Amar Abai ki tananami masis and domela kushi tanan. So Abai gives a simple explanation. Look, within the second brisa, we already know that there's a distinction between kushi and domela kushi. So we'll simply say that when the Mishnah and the brisa talk about kushi being pasul, it really means domela kushi, meaning it's a forgery, it's a counterfeit. By the way, you can see Rashi uses the word actually uses the words counterfeit. Rava Amar lo kasher halan v'halahu. Rava gives a different answer, and that is it depends who's using the esrog. If we're talking about the esrog that grows in Kush and it's used by the Kushim and they're used to that variety of esrog, so that's great, meaning for them it's going to be hadar. On the other hand, if we're going to use it and for us it's not in the normal shade of what the esrog looks like, so then for us it would be a deviation and it would be pasul. Okay. Esrog aboser. The Gemara turns its attention now to an esrog that's really immature. So, Rabbi Kiva posav v'chachamim machshirin. So here, a machlokes between Rabbi Kiva and the chachamim. Rabbi Kiva says that an immature esrog is going to be pasul. Now, Amar Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Shimon, Amar Davar Echad. So Rabbi says, here's what we can do. We can create an alignment between the sheets of Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Kiva hadamar, so we just learned Rabbi Kiva together, that the immature esrog is going to be pasul for the mitzvah of esrog, of dalaminim, and Rabbi Shimon Maihi. Now, as far as Rabbi Shimon is concerned, so that is going to be predicated on a brisa. It's actually a Mishnah. Rabbi Shimon Poter, es esrogim, bikot nam. Now, this is a Mishnah regarding the halachas of maestros, trumas of maestros, where Rabbi Shimon says that an esrog, if it is in a small state, meaning it is not yet ripened, it's immature, and you harvested them, so then they're not going to be chayv in trumas ha-maisros. And presumably the reason why is because it's at that point in time, since you cut it off at a very immature state, so therefore it is going to be not considered a pre. And so now let's create alignment. Meaning Rabbi Akiva says that a small esrog, the boser esrog, the immature esrog, cannot be used as your dalaminim. Why? Because the Torah demands pre-eitz hadar, and it's not a pre. Meaning cut off at an immature stage, it's not a pre. Similarly, Rabbi Shimon says that if I harvested the esrog and its small state, you're not chayv in trumas ha-maisros. Now, presumably why? Because trumas ha-maisros are only on peros, and this is not a pre. Okay, so that's the alignment that's created between the two. It sounds reasonable. Amale Abai Damalohi. Rabbi says, I don't know. I don't know if the two positions could be aligned. Throughout Shas, we see Abaye always trying to do this kind of exercise where he tries to align Tanayim. And over here, first of all, we see that Abai gets it from his Rebbe Rabba. Rabba was the one who does so. He does so, but interestingly enough, over here, Abai says, I don't think this is an alignment. Why? Because Ad kan lo kama Rebbe Kiva hacha debin and hadar v'leika avahasa k'rabban svirlei. So over here, it could very well be that the criteria of esrog for dalminim and esrog legabe masros, it could just simply be that it's a totally different criteria. In other words, for Esrog, what are we looking for? We're looking for Hadar. And it could very well be that Rabbi Kiva says, look, it may be a fruit, it's just simply not Hadar. Masha Ein came by Maisros, maybe he doesn't have to agree with Rabbi Shimon. Maybe he would tell you that it's a pri, and therefore Chayv and Shumas and Maisros. That's one way to distinguish. And Ina Miad Kan Lokam Rabbi Shimon Hasam Ala Dixiv Aser Taser Kol Tvus Zarecha Kederach Shebnei Adam Otsim Lizria Avahacha Kerabanan Sfirle. Now it could very well be that Rabbi Shimon's position that the small esrog is not chayv in Shumas and Maisros, it's not because it lacks a definition of being a pre. It's a pre. It just happens to be that for Shumas and Maisros there is another consideration, and that is the pasuk says in Parshas Re'eh Aser Taser Kol Tvus Zarecha. And that means to say that when is it a fruit that is now going to be chayav in Shumas and Maisros? That's when it's a fruit that can reproduce, meaning it's at this point in time where if I were to take the seed of this fruit and plant it, so I would get another fruit. So it could very well be that Rabbi Shimon happens to be of the position that an esrog that is plucked at such an immature state, it may be a fruit, just simply doesn't qualify for Shumas and Maisros because it yet no longer can regenerate. That could very well be the issue. And so therefore it has nothing to do with the definition of pre, and it could be that Rabbi Shimon would be fine using it for the mitzvah of Esrog for Dalaminim. Vesula Midi, and the Gemara says now as we turn to the Amud Beis, and the Gemara says, and look, there's really nothing more to discuss on this topic, meaning that Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Kiva are not necessarily in alignment with one another, and it could very well be that Rabbi Shimon may end up agreeing with the Bar Plukta of Rabbi Kiva and vice versa. Okay. And Adkan, and the Gemara says, and enough on that topic. Next topic, Gidlo B'defus. The Braisa, we're still going back to that Braisa we saw in the Amud Aleph, and that is if I grew the Esrog in a mold, V'asu k'minbiri acheres pasul, and the mold now basically transformed, meaning as the Esrog is growing within the mold, it is now going to obviously take the shape of its mold, and whatever the mold is, if it's not an Esrog mold, so then the Esrog comes out looking bizarre. It looks like a variant, and therefore it would be puzzle. So Amar Avaloshanu Lekim Inbriya Acheres Avakibriya So Kasher. Ah, the Gemara says, but let's say the mold is an esrog mold, meaning that what now it's going to do as the esrog is growing within the mold is the esrog is going to look out coming out like the shape of an esrog. So the Braisa says, sorry, Rava says that under those circumstances, yes, it would be kasher. To which the Gemara's response is Pshita. I think that's obvious. Kim Inbriya Acheres Tanan or Tanya. The Braisa says that if the mold has it coming out looking like another fruit, so then it would be pasul. So the inference obviously would be that if the mold has it looking like a esrog, so then it would be kosher. And not that they do this out in the fields, but there is certainly good motivation to make an esrog mold, and that would be to have the esrog basically looking like a picture-perfect esrog. Okay, they don't do that. They do a lot to make sure that the esrog comes out as perfect as possible, but anyway, so the Gemara says, so what's the Chiddush of Rava? So the Gemara says, L'tzricha Davide Dapi Dapi. So the Gemara says, the Chiddush of Rava is as follows. It's shaped like an esrog, but what the mold did is the mold created ridges within the esrog. Now, if you happen to have a picture over here, it would be really helpful. But basically, the shape is an esrog shape, but the ridges of the esrog kind of look, it looks saccharine. It looks artificial. Because now it doesn't have the natural surface area of an esrog. It basically comes out looking like ridges. So I might have thought under those circumstances that's a deviation and it would be pasul, and that's the chiddush of Rava. That because the general shape of the esrog is esrog-like, so therefore it would be kasher esrog. Itmar, we learned, esrog shenikvu achbarim, amarav ein zahadar. So if, let's say, your esrog was eaten by rats, okay, super unpleasant, right? Wake up in the morning, discover now that your esrog was just bitten by rats. So aside from the fact that the esrog is no good, you now fully understand that there are rats living in the same house you are. So, so a comment was made by Rav, ein zahadar. It lacks the requirement of hadar, and therefore it'd be no good. So, ini, the Gemara says, v'rabbi chanina matbel bei v'nafik bei. So the Gemara says, now I don't understand because we have to look at the practice of Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Chanina had a really unusual practice. And that was, is that he would bite into the esrog, okay, small bite, says Rashi, right? And after having taken a bite in the esrog, it's still the majority of the esrog remains, and he would use it to be, I would say, the mitzvah of Dalaminim. Okay, that's strange. So Ula Rabbi Chanina Kashi Masne. So now, obviously, before comparing Rabbi Chanina to the situation of the rat, where the rap bit into the esrog, and we said that's not hadar. So, but can we ask a simple question on Rabbi Chanina, and that is, how did he understand the Mishnah? Now, the Gemara says, Bishlam amasis and the Rabbi Chanina lokashi. Now, as far as the Mishnah and Rabbi Chanina are concerned, that really doesn't bother us that much. Why? Because kam b'yamtav rishon, kam b'yamtav sheni. Because the distinction is to be made between the first and second days of Sukkos. Now, again, when we say second day of Sukkos, we just simply mean the subsequent days of Sukkos. On the first day of Sukkos, so there's a requirement of ulekachtem, which we've said numerous times in this parak means lekichatama. It has to be a complete lekicha. And so that means that the esrog has to be totally intact. No part of the esrog could be missing. After the first day, meaning from the second day onward, so then there's this requirement of lekicha tama falls away, and so you can have an esrog that's chaser. So the kam b'yamtav rishon, kam b'yamtav sheni. So that's why now, if it lacks its completeness, meaning it's chaser, so from day two and onward, that would be fine. But ela le Rav Kasha. Now, it's difficult for Rav because Rav says that if you're rap baited, it's not hadar. So amlecha Rav, shani achbarim, the meise. But the Gemara says what we all know to be intuitive, and that is that if you were I to bite into it, it's not disgusting. I know some people may argue on that point, but in other words, that's okay. So you bit into it, good. Now give it to somebody else, let him bite into it. No one's going to be totally disgusted by that, but it goes without saying, but the Gemara says it, that if a rat bites into it, that's disgusting. And that's no longer just a failure of lekicha tama. That's a failure of hadar. It's no longer beautiful. Okay. Now, before we get to the ikadamre, so just to make a really important and interesting point over here, and that's the following. What we've just come to learn together is the following. On day number one, so there's a lot of requirements by an esrog, as there are by the other dalaminim as well. Notably, the min has to be there in total. It has to be lekicha tama. If it's chaser, if it's missing any part of it, so then it's going to be pasul. Okay. And what we just learned together is that subsequent to day number one, from day two and onward, so this requirement goes away. There doesn't have to be a lekicha tama. It can be chaser. What we also just learned together is that from day two and onward, there's still a hadar requirement. Hadar continues for all 7 days, even though from day two and onward is all midrabanan, but still the requirement of hadar is still necessary. Now this takes us back to the one of the opening Tosfosim of the Masechta. Of this Perek, where Tosfos asks a simple question: what's the difference between Hadar and Lekicha Tama? How come after day number one, Lekicha Tama requirement goes away, but the Hadar requirement stays? Why should that be? And Tosfos really struggles with that question. You could see Tosfos in the it's one of the first Tosfosim of the Perek. I'll give you the Mara Malkum just to look at the Tosfos. It's the last Tosfos on Chav Tes Amud Beis, Be'inan Hadar V'Leika. And see Tosfos over there who really struggles with this question and really and goes through a couple of iterations of trying to understand why the difference. If you look at Rashi right here in our daf, so Rashi says, I'll tell you the difference. So Rashi writes, El L'Rav, right? Dibra Maschal El L'Rav. I'll read the Rashi inside. Da'amra Ein Zeh Hadar Kasha De Rabbi Chanin Zeh Havila B'Sheni Na'am El L'Rav Lo Nafik Da'ha Mitzvah Hadur Be'inan So Rashi writes over here, the reason why Hadar is necessary even after the first day is because you're masker shem shemayim. Rashi says it's the bracha. Meaning what the bracha demands is that the esrog be an esrog hadar. That by virtue of the fact that we're going to be saying a bracha on it, meaning even though it's the rabbanan, but still part of the takana Rav Yocham and Zakkai is to take the dalaminim for all subsequent days of Sukkot and to make a bracha on it. And since we're going to make a bracha on it, so therefore, it has to be hadar. Rashi here talks about the relationship between the hadar and the bracha. Because we're going to be making a bracha, therefore it has to be a hadar, right? And then Rashi quotes the beginning of the perek where clearly Yavesh is going to be a psul for all 7 days. Why? Because Yavesh is a failure of hadar, and hadar extends for all 7 days. But Rashi over here talks about this relationship between hidr and bracha. On the other hand, Lekicha Tama has nothing to do with bracha, meaning that if it's missing a part of it, it doesn't contradict the bracha. But hadar, however, if it lacks hadar, that would contradict the bracha. Okay, really interesting position of Rashi over here in terms of explaining the difference. And parenthetically, by the way, the Tosfos which I cited, which we didn't quote from, he does not give this approach. Tosfos gives a different approach. Anyway, really interesting Rashi in today's daf. Okay, now Ika Da'amri, now we're back in the Gemara, we're going to do this again, meaning a slightly different version, but we're going to basically cover the same points again. Am Rav Zehadar. Now, here in this variant version, so if the rat bit into it, it's still hadar. Meaning, obviously, this is different than the first version. In the first version, when the rat bits into it, so Rava declared that that's not hadar. Okay? In the second version, he says it's hadar. So the Rabbi Chanina matbil ba v'nafik ba, and this is consistent with Rabbi Chanina, who would also bite into a zestrog and be yotze. And the Gemara says, Rabbi Chanina kasha masnisin. Yeah, but isn't that against the Mishnah? The Gemara says, lo kasha kam yamtav rishon kam yamtav sheni. Now the Mishnah was talking about yamtav rishon, meaning there you can't, it can't be chaser, but from day two and onward it can be chaser. So that's fine. It's just the hadar requirement is something that you have to be concerned about for all subsequent days. But in the second version of the discussion, if a person bites into it, or even if a rat bites into it, it still remains to be hadar. It's chaser, but it's still hadar. Okay. And obviously the difference between the first and second version is what is this, does it lose its hadar status if a rat bites into it? Okay. Intuitively, I side with the first version over the second version, but again, hadar is subjective and okay, it doesn't. It, clearly, in the second version, if a rat bites into it, it still maintains its status of being hadar. Okay, esrog katan. I'm a rafam bar papa, but machlokas kan ka machlokas ba'avanim mikurazolos. The Gemara over here makes another comparison for the day. This one may be even more interesting than the first one. We attempted this morning to make a comparison between the psul of dalaminim and trefa. And over here now we're going to make another comparison between the size of an esrog and the size of stones. Stones, what kind of stones are we talking about? The stones that would be used for cleansing after having gone to the bathroom, right? There was once upon a time where people did not use tissues and toilet paper. And they use stones. So, and on Shabbos, the consideration is that, generally speaking, stones are moksah. But obviously, over here, we're talking about kavod abrios. So kavod abrios is going to override moksah, and therefore, you could use stones. So, the size of the stones is what we're describing over here. We learned in the brayso of Shabbos, gimel avanim mikura zelos mutar lachnis a beis akisa v'kamishi uran. Rabbi Meir Omer ke'egos, Rabbi Yehuda Omer ke'beitza. It happens to be that this same machlokas in terms of the size of the stones regarding hygiene after having gone to the bathroom is going to be the same machlokas that we have over here. Now, interestingly enough, oddly enough, I actually see the connection really clearly. Meaning, because basically, when are the stones not going to be considered muksa? When you can handle them. Meaning, obviously, the stones are meant for handling. Obviously, for two totally different purposes, but still, the point is that you're handling the stones. So over here, the debate whether or not it's going to be the size of a egos or the size of a beitza, but basically it's a question of when are they best suited to be handled, and the same thing is true over here regarding the esrog. Finishing up to the Mishnah, uvegadol kadesh yochas tanya amir Rav Yosi ma'isa b'Rav Yekiva shabal beis haknesses ve'esrog aktefo. We're talking about the largest size esrog, and the Gemara tells a phenomenal story of Rav Yosi reporting that Rav Yekiva came in with his esrog. And it was on his shoulder, basically the size of a watermelon, on his shoulder. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Misham Rayaf, Heim Amrulo, Ein Zahadar. And Rabbi Yehuda turns his attention. Rabbi Yehuda says, "No, that's not hadar. It's not beautiful." Now, Rashi notes that hopefully you remember the Gemara from Lamed Aleph. The Gemara in Lamed Aleph explained that according to Rabbi Yehuda, hadar has nothing to do with this discussion. Remember, according to Rabbi Yehuda, it has to be something that you can handle. And with one hand. And if necessary, you have to pass the lulav and the esrog between the two hands. So it had nothing to do with hadar. So his comment over here of Ein Zahadar seems to be a little bit strange, but Rashi says that he was just discussing it in the context of Rabbi Kiva's viewpoint, meaning that Rabbi Yosi wanted to show Rabbi Kiva that this is still within the realm of hadar. And Rabbi Huda's response is, even if you're operating within a hadar discussion, it's not beautiful. But as far as I'm concerned, the shear has nothing to do with hadar. It has to do with its ability to be handled. Okay, Adkan. The Aguda discussion we're going to leave off for tomorrow, and this is a good place to stop, to pause, and tomorrow we'll pick it up with the Mishnah and the mitzvah la'ogdo and the binding of the dalminim. So that we'll continue with tomorrow. Anyway, let's quickly recap. Let's review our daf today. A lot of information came up in today's daf. Today we started off, we opened up with all the physical imperfections that exist within an esrog. And we discussed where, number one, you have a perforation in the esrog, but none of the esrog is actually missing. So even though the Mishnah says it's kosher, let me go further back. We talked about the blistering of the esrog. If there are blisters on the surface area of the esrog, so if it covers the majority of the esrog is pasul, and if it covers a minority, it's kosher. And Rav qualified the second half of the Mishnah. And that is that even if the blisters are covering a minority, but if it is distributed over two or three different sections of the esrog, so the esrog is pasul. Truth of the matter is that even as a summary, there's still a lot more details to cover in this halacha. Okay, but that's just the beginning. Then Rava said that if the blisters are on the chotam of the esrog, the nose of the esrog, so then it's going to be pasul. Rashi says because everyone's draws their attention first to the chotam of the esrog, and that's why over there it will be most evident. It will be easily perceivable that there is an imperfection existing within the chotam of the esrog. Then we talked about the peeled esrog, a stira between two comments regarding the peeled esrog and the Gemara's resolution. And this is Rashi's understanding, is that if it's fully peeled, it would be kosher. Partially peeled, it's menumar, and therefore would be pasul. If there is a crack in the esrog, if there's a perforation in the esrog, so if the perforation goes all the way through the esrog is pasul, even though no part of the esrog is missing. If there's an indentation in the esrog the size of an iser, so then the esrog would be pasul, even though no part of it's missing, it's just simply imprinted, it's indented. The Gemara asked a question about an esrog that is basically liquid inside, all right? Outside intact, but liquid inside. What is the status of that esrog? The Gemara made two attempts to try to answer this question, both coming out to be inconclusive. And the first attempt was to compare this to the halachas of treifa. Okay. We know that a lung that is where the insides have been liquefied, as long as the bronchial tubes are still intact, the animal is not rendered a treifa. Over here, maybe the same thing. The Gemara says it's not a fair comparison. The esrog that does not grow a particular shade of color in our region, and you grew it a different shade, even though in other areas and other communities that is perfectly acceptable and normal, but over here it's not normal, so that esrog would be pasul. That's the kushi and doma lakushi discussion the Gemara had. The esrog that is immature, so machlok is between Rabbi Kiva and the Chacham, and whether it's pasul or kasher. And what the Gemara tried to do is align the shitas of Rabbi Kiva here and the shita of Rabbi Shimon as it relates to the halachas of Chumas and Maizos. And Abaye says the comparison is not a fair comparison. As we are now up to the Lamed Vav Amud Beis in terms of our review. We talked about an esrog that is grown in a mold, taking on its shape of a different fruit. It's pasul. If the mold happens to recreate the shape of the esrog, that would be fine. Even if it looks a little artificial. In other words, there are nice even ridges that are growing within the esrog based on the mold. That would still be fine. And then a big discussion over here is that after day number one, the esrog can be chaser. Even though part of the esrog is missing, where the Gemara quotes Rabbi Chanina would bite into his esrog on day two and onward and still make a bracha and be yotzizan with the esrog, even though it's missing a part of it, and that would be fine. And so the Gemara says, look, the issue over there is that it's still hadar. It's just chaser. And after day number one, it still needs to be hadar. It does not need to be shalem. It could be chaser. Good. The question of the rat bites into it, is that considered hadar or not hadar? A difference between version number one, version number two. And also, I made a big deal this morning about Rashi, where Rashi says that the reason why the hadar requirement has stayed on even after day number one, where most of the other requirements go away, right? The shalem requirement no longer is necessary after day number one. Right. Best kept secret, which is not a secret, is that if your pitum breaks after day number one. Now, again, what I'm not discussing today is Yontov Sheni Shel Galios, which is a major discussion. I'm not discussing that. I'm just right now simplifying the discussion to just simply day number one versus the other days of Sukkos. So, if the pitum breaks after day number one, the esrog is fine. Meaning, it's just a question of it being chaser, and it's fine. It's a best kept secret, and no one seems to know this, but. Anyway, that's fine. So and I made a big deal of the Rashi, where Rashi explains that the hadar requirement continues from day one and onward because there's a relationship between hiddur and bracha. Since you're going to be making a bracha on it, therefore it needs to be hadar. On the other hand, all the other technicalities of shalem, so there's no stira between the esrog being chaser and you making a bracha on it. And finally, the small size of an esrog, machlokes between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, and it happens to be they're also debating the size of the stone that can be used for wiping oneself after having gone to the bathroom on Shabbos. And again, the question of kavod abrios versus the esrog muksa. And finally, the large esrog. The Gemara finished off today by telling us a story of Rabbi Akiva coming in with an esrog on his shoulder. In other words, it was exceedingly large. And Rabbi Yehuda says, no, they told him it's not a kosher esrog.